Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, my colleagues. First, I would like to express my deep gratitude to Professor Cole Durham and all the people of BYU for such beautiful organizing this meeting and for giving me the opportunity to be among such unique gathering. Today, I'm going to present a piece of work titled by Islam and Religious Freedom and the Role of Interreligious Dialogue in Promoting Global Peace. And to talk about this title, actually, I'm going to tackle four different parameters. The first parameter will be what is the background of the problem itself? And the second parameter will be the stand of Islam towards religious freedom. And the third parameter will be the role of inter-religious dialogue in creating peaceful coexistence among the believers of the different religions. And the last parameter, I will mention the role of Egypt and the efforts of Egypt in the field of interreligious dialogue over the last 20 years on the international level and on the regional and the national level. But before tackling these four parameters, let me start by a piece of the historical speech of President Obama when he came to Egypt last June, on 4th of June, and he gave his historical speech in Cairo University. Actually, he said, the U.S. seeks a new beginning with Muslim communities around the world, based on the shared principles of justice, progress, tolerance, and the dignity of all human beings. Obama also said, it is firm in my belief that the interests we share as human beings are far more powerful than the forces that drive us apart. This message has been mentioned in the historical speech of Obama, actually was mentioned again in the Quran more than 14 centuries ago. God the Almighty said, O mankind, indeed, we have created you from male and female and made you people and the tribes that you may know one another. It should therefore become the premises of our gathering to foster peace and eliminate tension and conflicts which dominate many regions of our world, which is supposed to be a place for human civilization. So the message for all of us today is to foster peace and eliminate tension and conflicts. And first, if I want to talk about the background of the problem, all of us agree that after 9/11, lots of things has happened global-wise. And in the shadow of 9/11, 2001, interest in interfaith dialogue boomed up as an essential tool for bridging the divide in modern societies with multiple identities and the religious pluralism, which is deeply shaped by globalization. Now it is high time for the great majority who are convinced and supporting peaceful coexistence between believers of different faith and beliefs as a cornerstone to global peace and justice to strongly take the initiative for isolating those who are working desperately by all means to keep the road open for fanaticism, extremism, violence, and clashes. But fulfillment of the goal will build up day after day through the practical behaviors of people who belong to different religions, cultures, and civilizations, global-wise, when they conduct a dialogue and get to know each other correctly, respecting the privacy of each other, and discover the commonalities which gather them. The above mentioned goal will be achieved by declarations and the recommendations, but not only by declarations and recommendations. At the elite level, like us here, we are talking and hearing the echo of what we see, of what we say, but primarily through institutional work of the international organizations, the civil societies, and the governments to reach politicians, decision makers, community leaders, and most important, people at the grassroots level. Because always the problems come from the grassroots levels and from this age group between 7 years and 18 years and between 18 and 35 years. This is actually the critical age group of creating problems. So we have to take all what we are believe in to the grassroots level. The second parameter is, what is the stand of Islam towards the religious freedom? Is Islam opposed to the religious freedom? The answer is no, and it's very, very big no. And I'm going to mention some evidences that Islam does not oppose religious freedom, but it encourages and accepts religious freedom. And someone might say, You Muslims keep talking about Islam and what happened more than 14 centuries ago. We want to talk about the present time and the future. And I believe in that. I am for the present and the future, and I'm not for the past. But in order to get a good present time and the future, successful future, we have to know the past well. That's why we have to encourage people of different religions to know more about their own religions and to know more about the other's religions and to know about history and dig deeply and find out facts, because most of the conflicts and most of the problems comes from either ignorance of the informations or misuse of the information or abuse of the information. So I'll give some evidences that Islam does not oppose the freedom belief. Islam guarantees the freedom of religion. This is verified in the following Quranic verse. Let there be no compulsion in religion. And all the Quranic verses are documented here by the number of the surah and the number of the verse, and you will find it in your documents. The other evidence is then believe that one's freedom to adhere to the religion of one's choice establishes the base of his belief. And this emphasizes the following Quranic verse. Let him he will believe, and let him who will reject. No problem. The other evidence, declaring the freedom of belief, means Islam accepting that there is more than one religion. If he declares the freedom of belief, so automatically he Islam accepts the presence of more than one religion. This was stressed by the Prophet Muhammad in the first constitution of the Islamic State in Al-Madinah. When Muhammad moved in Al-Hijra from Mecca to Al-Madinah and settled down there, he gave the first constitution for the Islamic State. When he acknowledged Judaism in Al-Madinah and they declared that Jews and the Muslims in Al-Madinah formed one nation. The other evidence is an example of Islam granting religious freedom is Umar ibn al-Khattab. Umar ibn al-Khattab is one of the companions of Prophet Muhammad. And Umar ibn al-Khattab treated the Christians of Jerusalem in a fantastic way. He guaranteed the safety of their lives, their churches, and their crosses assuring them that none of them would be harmed on account of his religion. These are facts documented in history and in religion and in everywhere. Also, Islam grants freedom of thought and opinion, provided that discussions on religion are of an objective nature and are not a pretext for abuse or ridicule. This is stated in the following Quranic verse: invite all to the way of your Creator with wisdom and beautiful preaching, and argue with them in ways that are best and most gracious. This is the advice of Islam if I'm going to talk to the others. The other evidence in the light of this tolerance: discussions may take place between Muslims and non-Muslims. The Quran invites the Muslims to discuss matters with the people of the book. In the following Quranic verse, God the Almighty said, "O people of the book, come to common terms. As between us and you, that we worship none but God, that we associate no partners with him, that we elect not from among ourselves lords and patrons other than God. If then they turn back, say, bear witness that we at least are Muslims bowing to the will of God." This verifies that should be the discussion between both parties fail to accomplish its aim, each person is entitled to adhere to the faith in which he believes. This also was the following Quranic verse expressed concerning the Prophet Muhammad's final remarks to the pagan of Mecca, namely, "You have your religion and I have mine." No problem. You have your religion and I have mine. The third important parameter I'm trying to tackle in this presentation, actually, is the importance of interfaith dialogue in peaceful coexistence between the believers of different religions. And in order to know about that, we have to ask two important questions. How can interreligious dialogue regain trust between the Islamic world and the West? Because the trust between Islamic world and the West has been shaken for so many reasons, it's not the time to talk about it now. And you know most of it. The second question is, how can interreligious dialogue connecting communities of discourse? In order to conduct successful, effective interreligious dialogue, we have to have five important prerequisites for the dialogue to be successful. These five prerequisites are recognition of the other, mutual respect, dialogue between the two parties, tolerance with the other, and the last prerequisite is to joint cooperation between the two parties. But because these five prerequisites are so important, so please allow me to talk about it in some details. If we talk about recognition of the other and dealing with him on the basis of equality, this is a fundamental prerequisite that cannot be overlooked. Otherwise, would be eliminated and his existence would equal to his non-existence. This is the other. Consequently, there would be no parties each recognizing the other, but there would be only one party, dominating party, giving orders to be obeyed by the other and enforcing its will on that other and rejecting any opposition to its stance, in which case there could be no way to establish trust between the two parties concerned. So the dialogue will fail. The second prerequisite is the mutual respect. The mere recognition of the other is not sufficient. Just to recognize the other is not sufficient. This means that each party should respect the other, his religion, his faith, his belief, his customs, his tradition, and civilization, and the cultural characteristics, and in general, his human rights. This mutual respect is the first true basis for any dialogue or understanding or cooperation between the two parties. It must be taken in consideration here that mutual respect not necessarily means accepting the stance of the other. This is something, and it's not essential to accept the stance of the other, but it means the willingness of every party to listen to the other and to accept in a constructive way his ideas and his criticism too. The third prerequisite for successful interreligious dialogue is dialogue between the two parties. Dialogue between the two parties is the natural outcome of the recognition of the other and the mutual respect. If I recognize the other and I respect him, so automatically I will conduct a dialogue with him. And understanding between the two parties. Through dialogue, each party may understand the other, its stance, its position, its circumstances, its beliefs, and the characteristics of its civilization. Moreover, dialogue eliminates the misunderstanding as well as the preconceived ideas and misconception of each party towards the other. Dialogue likewise makes it possible for both parties to identify common grounds in their civilizations, culture, or history, or the fields that may be utilized for interest of both. The fourth prerequisite is tolerance with the other. Dialogue, as mentioned above, is not an end of itself, but it is a mean to achieve tolerance, which in turn promotes cultural exchange, common understanding, and the positive and peaceful coexistence, and consolidates the roots of mutual cooperation in all spheres and at all levels. And the last prerequisite is the joint cooperation. There is no doubt that an atmosphere such as that mentioned above paves the way for establishing trust and promoting cooperation between the two parties, a matter which could ultimately lead to the expansion of the scope of cooperation, not only between the two parties, but with others as well, so that all may cooperate in laying down the foundation for peace and stability in the whole world, our common world, and our ultimate goal, which is global peace. The last and fourth parameter of this presentation will be the role of Egypt in promoting interfaith dialogue. And actually, to save time for the ground, I'll cross all this and tackle directly what Egypt has done on the international level regarding interfaith and interreligious dialogue. First, Egypt has made an agreement between Al-Azhar and the Vatican. And very quickly, I mentioned to you that the Muslim world has three authority bodies. The first authority body is Al-Azhar, Al-Azhar Mosque and University, because in Islam, the mosque is an integrated institute for education too. So now we have Al-Azhar Mosque and Al-Azhar University, where I am a professor of medicine in Al-Azhar University. The second authority body for the whole Muslim world is the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs, where I am a member and in the Commission of Interfaith Dialogue. And the third authority body is Dar al-Ifta, or the House of Ifta. Ifta is an Arabic word, means to find out the correct Islamic answer for any problem or for any modern issue, has been appeared in the recent time by the religious leaders. Something like organ transplantations, something like all these new issues. We have to find out what is the stand of Islam in it. So this is the role of Dar al-Ifta. And it happens that the three authority body, Al-Azhar, Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs, and Dar al-Ifta are in Egypt, in Cairo. Okay? So we had made a treaty between Al-Azhar and the Vatican in year 1998. And we put some rules, and accordingly, there is regular meeting between Al-Azhar and the Vatican quarter a year to discuss the problem between Muslim, Christian, Catholic dialogue. And after fulfilling that treaty, actually, Paul II came to Al-Azhar twice, and he gave speeches, and I would say that a lot of positive attitudes has happened after this treaty. The second treaty we have done is between Al-Azhar and the Church of England, the Church of Canterbury. When the Archbishop of Canterbury was Lord Kerry at that time, and this was in year 2001, and we followed the same regulations which we have done with the Vatican. So we conducted Muslim, Christian, Anglican dialogue with the Church of England. And the main basis of this treaty is to keep the corner of the faith and the corner of the belief not open for discussion. Because if we open discussion in the faith and in the belief, it will be a hell, okay? But because the ethical codes and the common grounds which we are sharing, Muslims and the Christians, are so vast, so we can conduct dialogue in these commonalities. The third activity which Egypt has done, actually, is Egypt hosted Davos twice in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And when I mention Davos actually is a World Economic Forum, and it is interested only in how to improve the economical status of the world. But what happened actually, after 9/11, we started to talk with the founder of the World Economic Forum, Professor Schwab, and we convinced him that it's so essential to have stability for the success of the economical situation of the whole body. So we implemented a religious parameter along with the World Economic Forum, and we attended the World Economic Forum once in Switzerland in year 2003, and two times hosted in Egypt in Sharm el-Sheikh, and a fourth time in 2002, when the World Economic Forum actually moved to the United States and was held in New York. And 2002 was the era, the peak era of Samuel Huntington talking about the clash of civilizations. And the meeting of World Economic Forum, Davos, in New York at that time, and we made a panel between we Muslims and Samuel Huntington himself, and it was a very, very successful meeting, and things started to change, and the tension of the clash of civilizations started, the plateau started to go down. Also, Egypt also, actually, we have done a very good successful thing, because we believe that we shouldn't keep talking in closed rooms with religious leaders, and we hear the echo of each other, and that's all. This won't let the dialogue proceed. So, like we did in Davos, a religious parameter along with the World Economic Forum, we did in the Olympiad in 2004. The Olympic Games was held in Athens at that time. And with communication and cooperation with the Orthodox Church, actually, of Alexandria, we went and being hosted in the Olympic Games, and we conducted the dialogue through the Olympic Games, and again, the outcome was very, very positive. This is regarding the activities of Egypt in promoting interreligious dialogue on the international level. On the regional level, actually, in Jordan, there is a very important institution called the Arab Thought Foundation, and it is headed by Prince Al Hassan Ibn Talal, and they have a very good activities in inter-religious dialogue. So we have communication with this foundation, and we conduct very strong steps in dialogue with the Russian University of Petersburg. So we have a triad, Egypt and Jordan and Russia through the University of Petersburg, and we proceeded and achieved the success in inter-religious dialogue. Again, on the regional level, actually, Egypt participated with Saudi Arabia in what is known the very famous meeting of Mecca. And this Mecca meeting in interreligious dialogue was the basis later on. Mecca meeting was in 2008, and then it was the base for the Madrid meeting and the base for the New York meeting about civilization inter-dialogue. And lastly, I will talk about the national level, the activities of Egypt on the national level. And actually, on the national level, it is mainly through the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs. We have our annual meeting every year, and we conduct in parallel with the annual meeting a roundtable discussion for interfaith dialogue. And thank you very much for listening to me.